Alright, it's 10:20 a.m. June 8th. I'm standing just outside this, I don't know what you call it, this huge container thing. And I just heard, I swear to Christ, it was a violin. A violin being played somewhere far away. I couldn't get the recorder on in time. So I'm just going to, gonna wait here for a while and see if that happens again. My name is Bruce Kosh. I'm a freelance writer and reporter. Before it was unofficially and cynically renamed Echo Town, the place I want to tell you about was called Rarity Computing West, one of the most expansive tech campuses in North America. Conceived and paid for by the Phan brothers, Nung and Piel, the Vietnamese dynamos who had been bringing the world's fastest laptop processors and cloud storage machinery to global business year after year. They bought 12,000 empty acres on the east side of Charleston, South Carolina, and went about constructing a multi-use complex to rival the ones they'd already built in Germany and South Korea. Thousands of employees were going to work and even live there, in the most modern office buildings and boutique apartments. There would be a self-contained shopping district, a streetcar system, even a full recreational park, all for the benefit of Rarity's highly trained white-collar tribe. It was going to dramatically alter the face of the area's economy. But the financial crisis of 2026, combined with a couple of very bad gambles on unproven tech, brought everything to an ugly, skidding halt. The Phan brothers frantically halted construction on the campus 4 days before Christmas, and I still remember how the stock market freaked out. About 70% of the brothers' wealth disappeared in 6 months. Rarity Computing West was abandoned. It was such a massive property, with so much of it already half-developed, that finding some other wealthy concern to step in to repurpose the land was going to take years if the Phans didn't sell. And ever optimistic, they refused to entertain offers. And so block upon block upon block of gaunt skeletal structures remained near the banks of the Cooper River north of the Septima Clark Parkway. 7 temporary operations centers were emptied out and stripped. Even a couple of payloaders were just left to rot amongst all of that concrete, steel, dirt, iron, and rubble. The 3 crumbling parking lots beside an old minor league baseball stadium that had been demolished to build the new Rarity U.S. corporate offices were left with long, ragged tears in them, creating gullies 2 feet deep, as if the claws of some massive, angry animal had come down from the sky. It was spooky from day one, people said, and from having seen videos and photos of the place long before I ever went there to write an article about it, I can attest. Building after building, their growth thwarted in mid-bloom. No windows yet installed in most of them, no sides on most of them. Insulation and loose boards knocked around in the wind, mounds of debris 20 feet high blocking entire blocks. And all of it completely silent. The Charleston police had a problem on their hands. The area surrounding RC West was not especially crime-ridden, but such an enormous expanse was bound to draw in some rather frightening elements. And so, at taxpayers' extra expense, the place had to be patrolled regularly after it became a desert. They noticed something strange by the spring of 2027. There was no crime. There were no people. No vagrants, no homeless, no scavengers, no pranking teenagers creeping past the low cement barriers ringing the acreage. Only in summer would come the miles of chain-link fence and warning signs. There weren't even any Instagram-happy hipsters wanting to slap fancy filters on photos of the abandoned zone seen at sunrise. No one was coming into the place, not in the middle of the day, not in the middle of the night, to to either cover open surfaces with graffiti or burn everything flammable in sight. There were zero calls for assistance, zero calls to report a fire or maybe some guy attacked by a junkie while unwisely walking his dog near the ruins of the so-called shopping district. You would see the very occasional panoramic shot of RC West online, but news outlets all tended to use the same ones in their stories on the downfall of the company. It was simply as if people were spooked to go in there. My first interviews with the Charleston police seemed to confirm this was true. Bad vibes is the phrase I heard most often from the men and women in uniform who drove and walked through the area as summer became fall and then winter, cloaking it in even deeper grays and browns. Around that time, the name Echo Town sprang up online and across social media. No one was quite sure where it came from, but a field day was had with it. It seemed an especially cruel dig at the Fahn brothers' naked ambition, and there was no shortage of people delighting in the schadenfreude that came with their fast fade from public view after years of relentless appearances on magazine covers and TV. Nung, the older one, brash and boastful, and PL, the real intellect between them, modest on the surface, but unable to stop himself from touting his own scientific and business acumen at the slightest provocation. The name Echo Town, or sometimes even Stalingrad West, accompanied most references to them, until the brothers essentially disappeared, mightily humbled, and pursued by round after round of litigation, even as they maintained just enough financial swagger to hold on to their dream property. By then, the darker stories had begun to make their rounds. The stories that really made Echo Town what it is. The first eerie tale I ever became aware of was almost prosaic in comparison to what would follow. It was nothing more than a post to an online forum about goings-on in the nearby neighborhoods of Nomo and East Central. A patrolman working out of Romney Street Station wrote that while he was performing the typical nightly drive through Echo Town's unnamed muddy lanes, he stopped his cruiser and rolled his window down upon hearing something unusual. It was 11:30 p.m. He got out of the car and listened to a strange sequence of alternating sounds from within the bleak shadows of a cadaverous building to his right. There would come the firm double tap of a small iron object striking another one. After a pause, there would be a response from a building on his left, a sound like the plastic claws of a cheap lawn rake drawn slowly down or across a cement surface. The patrolman trained his flashlight on each building in turn, poking the beam through the glassless windows, past dangling strips of mangled plastic sheeting. He saw nothing. A full minute would go by, and then the pattern would sound again. Two taps to his right, the elongated scratching to his left. Purposeful, directed. He took a few cautious steps into the dank, absolute darkness of one of the structures, but his flashlight revealed nothing, even when the pattern continued, with always just a little variance in the timing and pitch of the wordless conversation. Mentioning the phenomenon to a colleague the next day, the patrolman noted that, at long last, evidence of human presence inside Echo Town had been found. When I finally tracked that patrolman down for my article, he was quite credible. Like I say, nothing overtly spooky in the tale. The following March, though, 15 months after the end of construction, things got a little more strange. I came across the story of a two-person crew that went on location in Echo Town for WCIV-TV News. They'd set up a single wide shot of the low, grim skyline as a living background for a report on the many local economic consequences of Rarity's badly botched dream. Moments before reporter Liza Kent began to speak to the camera, so the story went. The camera operator waved her off because of a distraction far in the background of the shot. It was because of those alleged 15 seconds of pre-roll video footage that I came to speak to the cameraman, Mike Ratzenkast, who had since left the profession and was a partner in a marijuana dispensary when I met him. He claimed to remember the day well and told me he'd watched the footage before it was deleted. What had threatened to ruin the shot, he told me as we sipped whiskey on his porch, was a procession of four human figures far in the background. Four elderly people hobbling slowly from point to point amidst the false city's aging remains. Each held low to their sides what looked like plastic shopping bags containing unknown items. They appeared and then disappeared behind the facade of one of the buildings. Ratzenkast, stunned to see people in Echo Town, had actually called out to them from a distance, but was unable to get their attention. He remembered one particular detail of those people more vividly than any other, and that was their appearance of great age. Granted, these people were 100 yards away, but still, it seemed to him they were at least in their 80s, and couldn't possibly have any reason to be there. When it was clear they would not reemerge from wherever they had gone, he and Liza Kent commenced their shot, wrapped it up in two takes for use on the evening's broadcast, and left. Unfortunately, Ms. Kent herself had no reliable memory of the incident. Time became more and more cruel to Echo Town. Hurricane Claudette's brush with the region displaced much of the rubble, scattering the loose contents, shifting them around, sketching a slightly altered landscape, but one that was just as melancholy. It also wiped out a full mile of the protective chain-link fence around the area. Echo Town's second wet winter caused the subsidence and collapse of two of the buildings. Then came "Press Here." Those words were spotted and photographed in four different places, words painted on random patches of brick, cement, and steel in uneasy letters a foot high. Each phrase sprouted a long arrow pointing to a simple black dot the size of a dinner plate. A most curious call to action. Almost amusing until you actually walked up and placed your hand on one of the black dots. What happened then was first explained to me by a surveyor compiling a final report on Hurricane Claudette's flooding effects on Charleston's east side. She had entered Echo Town with her 9-year-old daughter, having no child care for her on that particular day. As she leaned against her SUV and made some notes on her iPad, her little girl had seen the words "Press Here" at about chest height on a wall, and she obeyed the command. When she touched the black dot, a shrill, wavering, androgynous laugh erupted somewhere far away. But the owner of that voice did not reveal him or herself. The little girl touched it again. Again came the laugh, which the surveyor, Michelle Neal, described as slightly crazed and unhappy. In writing my article, I collected three different reports of this phenomenon, spaced out by weeks. The other two were from a real estate insurance auditor and a heavily tattooed installation artist who had crept into Echo Town to get ideas for a possible diorama based on the haunting landscapes created by its remains. In each case, no matter which one of the four buttons was quote-unquote pressed, the result was that same instantaneous, somewhat ghastly laughter from afar. The installation artist tried to mimic it for me as we stood in his studio apartment at Mount Pleasant, frustrated that he couldn't accurately convey its plaintive properties. I was glad he stopped trying. Were there people living somewhere in Echo Town? That was the question. And if so, how could they have gone essentially unseen and undetected for so long? Where was the inevitable crime that should have come in their wake? The emergency calls for medical assistance, the chatter about them in the surrounding neighborhoods. When enough rumor had finally surfaced, Charleston County Social Services investigated, but found no evidence of possessions or even unusual accumulations of trash, nor did they actually see anyone. But they did find the doctor's office. There were two mammoth gray metal oblong storage containers set up near the railroad tracks, having offloaded their contents long ago. 80 feet long, they were open on one end, and one of the investigators got curious about the total darkness in there. It took more than one flashlight to banish it. On one interior wall, in thick white chalk, someone had worked up a tall, crude approximation of the rod of Asclepius, which we know better as the snake and staff symbol representing the world of medicine. Before it, on the filthy floor, were some empty crates supporting a mismatched assembly of wooden planks that comprised a long table. Beside this, an upturned 50-gallon drum supported an assortment of objects so profoundly rusted as to be utterly unfunctional. Two scalpels, a forceps, a large retractor, several empty syringes, and oddest of all, some kind of machine the size of a clock radio. The glass dials were filmed over with mold. "That's a bipolar coagulator," my doctor told me when I showed him the photo of the room that I'd gone great lengths to uncover. "It controls bleeding and charring in neurosurgery." Draped across that primitive table was a very clean white sheet. The beginning of year 3 came for Echo Town with a January snowstorm, the strongest one in the area in 20 years. Those coffin-like storage containers became shrouded in drifts 2 feet high, but there was no one around to care. In February of 2029, a couple in West Ashley named Barrett received a phone call that their infant child had been kidnapped and that they were to leave $50,000 inside a building marked with a yellow X inside Echo Town, a place referred to by that exact name in the ransom note. The Barretts went right to the police. Mr. Barrett, watched by 3 sharpshooters and a half dozen FBI agents, took the money in a duffel bag to the designated spot, the hollow building once designed to house Rarity Computing West's offices of human resources. Waiting for him in there, on the unfinished second floor, was Lloyd Boykin, age 20, the sole author of the ransom note and the scheme itself. He was sitting crouched against a bare cement wall, and instead of accepting that bag full of marked bills, he asked Barrett to tell the police he was there, and that he wished to be arrested. The infant was beside him, safe and unharmed. Lloyd Boykin, later revealed to have an extremely low IQ, told the police that upon entering Echo Town that morning through one of the many troublesome gaps in the fencing, he had been approached and surrounded by people he did not know, and told by them that if he did not surrender the 6-month-old baby to its father immediately, his heart would be stopped. These people placed cold hands under his shirt and gripped the center of his chest, and he absolutely knew, that this was something that could and would be done to him. "Describe them," said the police. "They were children," he said. Boykin didn't want to say more until he'd had some sleep, but he never spoke of the encounter again on the record, and since it was immaterial to his confession, the matter was not pursued. He died only 2 weeks after his surrender, stabbed to death by a fellow inmate. If you wanted to experience some of the phenomena I've just recounted, but didn't have the ability or the courage to physically enter Echo Town, there was one other option as of 2028. If you're familiar with video games, you may have heard of Cloud Kings Ultra, the most ambitious space exploration and conquest game ever released. The company which created it was obligated to contract with hundreds of independent coders to develop, expand, and maintain in real time the galaxy that hundreds of thousands of players explored. The game hadn't been on the market for very long when rare reports surfaced of a tiny handful of players coming across a very strange place, deeply isolated on one of an untold number of stars available to them in the game for wandering. If your character was on the ground, in the right place, on the right star, at just the right time, you could conceivably encounter a geographical feature not approved by the company responsible for the game. A startling simulation of Echo Town could be explored on foot or by vehicle, complete with recent details generated through highly advanced GPS technology. This recreation seemed to be the dark joke of a rogue hacker. Every time this digital Echo Town was discovered and reported, the unknown prankster simply moved its location to some other barren star through sly programming, exploiting security flaws in the game's conception and architecture. To this day, there are only two videos online recorded by players as they guided their avatars through this creepy clone. The hacker, or hackers, had populated Echo Town with a handful of randomly generated, faceless, silent people who could never be approached. The programming loophole was eventually closed, but the identity of its weirdly dedicated perpetrator was never discovered. I finally came to Echo Town on an oppressively hot, muggy day in June, parking my rental car outside a length of tilting fence on the west side. I had actually delayed my arrival until a day that I could be assured there would be no direct sunlight. I wanted my photographs to possess the air of mystery that the place deserved. Clouds effectively choked off all satisfying colors of the light on June 8th and left the area gray and dismal, perfect for me. A member of the police department checked my credentials and unlocked a wired door cut into the fence, allowing me in. And then I was alone, needing only to take pictures and absorb as much imagery as I could for the final draft of my article for the Atlantic Monthly. Echo Town was as lonely and eerie as advertised. It hardly seemed possible that years after this monstrosity had been born, any of it should still be standing. I'd been warned to walk only in the center of the muddy lanes that had never become streets, for fear that rotting masonry or weather-torn girders might suddenly displace and descend, as it happened often in the past. The tallest building in Echo Town had once topped out at 8 stories high, 3 short of the architect's original goal, but that framework over the years had literally lost 2 stories to infirmity. The massive piles of dirt and debris had been worn down considerably, their contents withered by heat, cold, rain, and snow, sometimes simply washed away to other places. The deserts of cement that remained were extraordinarily warped and cracked and strangled by resilient grasses. I did not expect, nor had I ever heard spoken of, the curious whistling that greeted me as I walked lane to lane, turning randomly this way and that, craning my head to look up at the forlorn battlements. What little wind there was drifted and curled through uncountable holes and cracks and crevices, which would normally be closed by builders finishing their job. Here, the steps of a person walking alone were followed by that whistling sound that rose and fell in pitch but remained constant. I saw with my own eyes the fading yellow X that Lloyd Boykin had spray-painted on the side of the HR building and which had never been expunged, and I came across one of the "Press Here" directives scrawled on a freestanding wall that had never been joined with another, the drawn arrow that had once pointed to a black two-dimensional button now disappeared at its midpoint. The connecting brickwork had crumbled to the sidewalk some time ago, so there would be no uncanny laugh in the distance to greet me. 20 minutes later, I entered the long gray storage container that had enclosed the so-called doctor's office discovered by social services. The rod of Asclepius was still there, but the beam of my flashlight revealed that everything else was gone. As soon as I exited the container, I was greeted by a surprising sight. Two men were walking towards me, one of them raising his right arm in greeting. I felt reality completely displaced for a moment as I recognized their faces. It was Nung and Piel Phan in the flesh. I'd seen their photos a million times. No PR agent beside them, no driver. Just the two of them, dressed not in flawlessly tailored Brioni suits, but the kind of very unfashionable weekend clothes you'd expect to see on middle-aged men bowling alone somewhere. Nung shook my hand first and asked in his impressive English if I was the journalist who had come to do a story on Echo Town. They kept their ears to the ground, he said with a smile. Piel, the introverted one, shook my hand as well. Nung was willing to answer any questions I might have, and they were happy to clear up any misconceptions about Rarity Computing West and reveal its future. Taken completely aback, I told them I'd have to come up with something, as my request for their comments for the article had been twice declined by one of their representatives the month before. Nung nodded and waved the matter off. He said this was the first time they'd been on site since the end of construction, and might even have questions themselves. The three of us walked beside a shallow, 75-yard-long ditch, the genesis of a pond to be filled as one of the last stages of Rarity Computing West's completion. Nung did most of the talking, with Piel, who tended to lag behind, interested in offering not much more than a little clarity in technical details from time to time. His English was not nearly as proficient as his older brother's. Nung explained that while they couldn't discuss the ongoing legal issues everyone in the tech world knew they were still ensnared in, they could tell me that within 2 years, RC West would resume construction, albeit on a considerably smaller scale, to house a sizable acreage of cloud servers and the maintenance staff required to operate them. I already knew about this deal from my research, and I also knew that most business experts had given the brothers almost no chance to make the project happen. They'd never been able to shake their debt load, and there was real talk of jail time for both of them if the German government's case against them for fraud against a block of their original investors went forward. I played along with their talk, though, with PL seeming to feel most comfortable when he could use expansive hand gestures to illustrate his vision for their new company. I took notes and nodded a lot. To me, they felt and looked now like two rumpled middle managers who were trying to sell me on their past accomplishments. They seemed unperturbed by the somber atmosphere of Echo Town as we walked in a lazy square around the steel skeletons, occasionally detouring around a mound of rubble or a small sinkhole caused by the unsettled weather. I eventually asked Nung, "How do you feel about what they call this place now?" Unexpectedly, PL took over the talk then. We worked as hard as we could for as long as we could, he said. We are very ashamed this happened, but we will atone. That seemed an unusually candid phrase for him to use. Is it true people live here? He asked me. I told him that no one seemed to really know. That would be a very sad thing, PL said. We three looked around us and were silent for a moment. Nung hadn't shaved for a while. He rubbed his chin and stared emptily at a high spiking rod jutting up from the top floor of one of the structures, and he said it reminded him of a steeple. Then he reached out to shake my hand again. They both did, and said they hoped I would be fair but honest in my article, and reaffirmed that good things were ahead. With a mind like this one has, it's tough not to be optimistic, Nung said, smiling and pointing to his brother. He said they were a little tired from walking around, as they'd been here for quite a while before they found me, and said goodbye. Almost the very second that they turned away from me to head north, where I assumed a car was waiting for them, there was a loud thud from behind me and to the left. So close, I reflexively lifted my arms a few inches in self-defense before realizing I was in no danger. I started to walk hesitantly in the direction of the sound, then turned to look at the Fawn brothers to see their reaction. But strangely, they just kept on walking, and in a moment had turned a corner and were out of sight. Subsidence and collapse, I thought. This was a place of subsidence and collapse. I peered around a high, flat stack of rusted steel girders and saw two bodies on the ground, just a few feet from each other. The bodies had fallen from a substantial height. The coroner was not able to determine which one of the Fawn brothers' corpses was the first to slip out of the nooses someone had tied around their necks and descend to the ground below, anywhere from 2 to 8 hours after they'd been hung from a protruding girder on the 6th floor of the building intended for R.C. West's administrative staff. First, their killer had stabbed and burned them. The murders were committed by a mob-connected silent business partner, worried about the brothers' testimony in their fraud case. He lured them to Echotown to discuss its future and a possible way out from under. And then, I expect no one to believe the story of my encounter, and I never finished the article. If I did, I would end it by telling you that I don't believe any living person dwelled in Echotown for more than a moment, and that it is, instead, only an accidental sanctuary for ghosts. This morning, I read that the minimum security prison, whose land borders Echotown to the south, has been shut down. Budget cuts as the economy limps on, unable to right itself. And so, the living graveyard has essentially been extended by 5,000 more acres of buildings with no occupants, no purpose, and no oversight. It's 2030, and Echotown is still there. They say that if you get close to the border fence on the west side at midnight, you can hear phantom geese squawking near that shallow 75-yard-long ditch that was the genesis of a pond to be filled as one of the last stages of Rarity Computing West's completion. And I do wonder if if that is true. All right, it's been about 10 minutes since I heard that violin playing somewhere. I don't know, maybe the place is just getting to me and I'm hearing things, I don't know. But I'm totally out of battery, so I gotta shut it down. Jesus, there's two guys walking toward me. Yeah.